accession number 28804, reel number 5.
This is just a quick test for the start of this disc. So this is Barbara Hammond, reel 5.
Right.
Now, you were going to...
You're warm enough, dear.
I'm fine. You were going to tell us about some of the dangerous things that happened to you while you were out in the Middle East, because it wasn't all just going out and partying every night. There were three specific episodes that you remember.
Oh, yes, you're quite right. I think, first of all, when we all got into the Middle East, we had a lecture before we left to our different units, and one of them very much was that we must always be very, very careful that if we had to take a taxi anywhere, that we only went into that taxi with the driver and nobody else as a companion. Now, I didn't realise until this actually happened to me that it's quite different calling a taxi in a London street than in the middle of a village or even a small town where the Egyptians seemed to arrive from nowhere and clambered round anybody trying to get into any sort of limousine or taxi because they wanted to know how much the money would be and give me that and you give me that and pushing in and shoving. And to get into your taxi and get the door closed and get the driver to ask him to go off was quite a feat. Now, this happened to me, but it was almost disastrous, and I'll tell you what happened. I was returning from Alexandra, where I had been for the weekend with a friend of mine, and when we got to El Tel Kebir at 1 o'clock on the Monday afternoon, he said he wanted to get out with me and see that I was all right to get myself back to the hospital. He was going to go on for about another few miles to the holding unit at El Kassassin because he was being demobbed home. I said it was nonsense, I could easily manage, and I went my way. I assured him I would be perfectly all right and that he mustn't worry. I was in uniform and had a suitcase with me and also a travelling rug, a very good travelling rug. I immediately went to movement control at the station and asked the soldier, army soldier, British, if he could telephone the hospital to send down a car to transport me back there. It was about 3 miles, I think. That was at 1 p.m. By 2:30, the heat and the flies in the waiting room were unbearable. So, I requested another call to the hospital. By 3 o'clock, no transport had arrived, and was told, after a further call to the hospital, that they could not get anyone down to see me until about 5 p.m. So I decided that was it, and I would go and get a taxi from the yard. When I went outside the station, the stench was terrible, and a seething mass of Egyptian men and women surrounded me, demanding money when I called for a taxi. When the taxi drove up, I had difficulty in pushing myself and my luggage into the rear. As we were about to move, a second driver got in beside the other, and they raced onto the road alongside the Sweetwater Canal. Within a few minutes, they looked back at me and, with grins all over their faces, said, "We know taking you to hospitalis, sister." The QAINs also wore similar khaki uniforms to mine. And because I was in hospital, they thought I would be a nursing sister. And I knew by their faces that they weren't joking. I clutched my belongings and wondered how I could get out of the cab without injuring myself, as we were going so fast. Then, coming around the corner, was a large coach driven by an Egyptian, heading towards us on the wrong side of the road. My driver slowed down. I wrenched open my door and fell out onto the road with my luggage. And espied a WD ambulance manned by Africans coming up behind. They helped me up and drove me to the hospital, where I was revived with brandy. My colleague and a great friend telephoned our intelligence, and a major from that department arrived at 5 p.m. to interview me. He was so understanding, and I said I hadn't panicked, He was so understanding and said that I hadn't panicked and that I was lucky to be alive. He also said that I could have been taken to a nearby village out of bounds to all British hospital, to all British troops, because it was full of brothels and very, very undesirable characters inhabited it, and it would be very unlikely that I would ever have been returned or heard of again. They might have driven me into the desert, robbed and or raped me, and left me for dead. I never went near that station again. On a quite different occasion, I had returned to the hospital from a party. It was 2 in the morning, and all the lights were on in the sisters' quarters. Everyone was awake, and there was much activity. There had been a raid on our WD store close to our quarters. Before going into my bedroom, I was told that the raiding party, armed, had fired bullets through my room, some close to my bed, very visible when I examined the damage, and that I was thankful I had not been there that evening.
A lucky escape, really.
Yes, it was. Now, that's about those two. Do you want to know about the other one, the big girl?
Yes, I think so. Yes, because this happened to somebody else, but you were actually witness to it.
Another event during my stay in tech, as we called it, was so very sad. I was travelling in a van with others when a large truck ahead, full of soldiers and ATS from a different unit, suddenly stopped. Those inside had been sitting on benches facing each other and leaning on the canvas behind their backs. A similar vehicle, also with canvas sides, had passed by from the opposite direction. A metal object against their canvas had dealt a fatal blow to the head of a young ATS girl leaning against her canvas as the two vehicles passed, causing her immediate death. Because of the immense heat, she was buried after only a few hours and was lowered in her coffin into a quickly dug grave in the sand. Just a hole in the desert. I attended her funeral, full military honours, and I grieve for her family and friends, and for her, in the midst of life, alone and far from home. I really thought that was so dreadful.
And it really was just, she was buried in the middle of nowhere.
Immediately. Well, I suppose it was near some small village, but... Mm-hmm.
But there's no marker or anything.
I don't think so. Whether anybody came back later and made a cross, I don't know. Probably never even went out there. But I mean, that's so dreadful, isn't it?
And so instant.
Yes. That's that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear about my sister?
Oh, yes. What was your sister doing?
During my first 4 months in tech, I was able to meet up with my unmarried sister, Nancy. She was a Wren officer attached to the naval base in Suez. She was their fleet mail officer. It was wonderful seeing her. I was sad when her tour of duty ended in the autumn and she returned home to be demobbed. Meanwhile, my mother had suffered a severe stroke. She was only 58 and was being nursed at home, and my father just couldn't manage on his own. So in April 1946, I also went back by sea to England, where I was discharged on compassionate grounds.
But you managed to take a week's leave before you
had
to go.
Yes, did you want that?
Oh, yes, please.
Before going back, I spent a week touring Palestine and saw so many interesting places, but unfortunately, there was a curfew on Jerusalem at that time, so I was not allowed to go in. I fell in love with Haifa, visited Bethlehem and Capernaum, and also crossed the River Jordan one late evening, where I dined in a tent with members of the British Legion. We sat cross-legged and pulled a chicken, one each, apart with our bare hands. The moon was overhead that night, and we could hear the plaintive cry of the jackals. I felt so sad when I left Portside, so many good friends and colleagues that I might never see again. I was very happy to see my family on my return, but my heart was still heavy for the life I had left.
That must have been really quite a culture shock for you, though.
It was.
Going back to England.
It was. I was going to be there for 2 years, but I'm so glad I didn't. I never would have met my first husband upstairs, Raymond, and the one in my bedroom is Bill.
That was your second husband?
Yes. So you see, wasn't I lucky?
So fate always takes a turn in these
things. Yes.
But
what on earth was that?
It's the radiators. For anyone listening to the tape, don't worry, it's radiators. But it often fascinates me how much of a shock it must be, having all that freedom and the responsibilities and the power, if you will, because you're in a powerful position, and also living in such a lovely climate and having your own Batman, and then suddenly having to go back to England and live a completely different life.
It was dreadful, really. And of course, I was so lucky. I had lovely parents. And my father was a darling, but he just couldn't realise that by the time I came back, I was 26. And I had two brothers that I'd always danced with a lot, and they were like my brothers, really. Not my brothers, but the friends' sons, great friends' sons. And they were like my brothers, really. And I used to dance a lot with them. Well, one of them, during the war, got engaged to a Fanny and eventually married her. And the other one still was unmarried, but he was about 30. He was quite a lot older than me. And I always remember we decided to go to a big dance at the Grand Hotel in Brighton. And we went off, and I think we got back about 2 o'clock in the evening. Nothing. I mean, we weren't even keen on each other. We were just very good friends. And my father was standing up at home, absolutely, well, he wasn't livid, but he was so dismayed to think that, you know, that I was out with that young man at 2 o'clock in the morning. So that wasn't very easy. He just didn't understand. But you see, it was awful, really, that side of it. I mean, there were lots of things to compensate. But I found it terribly hard for the first few months. And then, of course, I went up to London and lived in London in different places.
I'll ask you about that in a second, because it's an interesting follow-up to what you were doing in the war. But just to be very mundane and boring, to finish this last section, if I can.
Yes.
The demobilisation process itself, you had a transport ship back to England, and then you were...
Yes, we arrived in the London docks.
And you went to Belgravia next.
Then I was transferred to a holding unit, and I think it was in Belgravia. And there were very few people there for dinner at night, because when I arrived I was given a room, and I had no luggage except just hand luggage. And of course I was still in all my old terrible, terrible uniform, because the ship I had been come home from was from India. It was an Indian ship, and it was pretty dicey. In fact, it came back when we got back to England. It went back to India, and then it came back again. And on that occasion, it had smallpox. Mm. So it was pretty awful, and I was very lucky to have missed that. So when I got back home, I hadn't had any sort of... hadn't had a bath. I'd still got my awful khaki drill on, and it was quite chilly. And I hadn't had my hair washed or anything. I mean, it was really dreadful. And I went into this frightfully immaculate and upmarket holding unit. And there were very few of us at dinner. And the CO, who was Mary Churchill, she was charming, and she asked me to sit, you know, next to her. And opposite her was, I think it was Winston Churchill's sister, either his sister or Clarissa's sister. But anyway, it was Mary's aunt. And I remember we talked a lot about her cat. And I remember thinking how terrible I was, and how out of place I felt in that sort of garb, etc., etc. And I was only too thankful that the following morning I had to do my demob, you know, at the unit, and then get onto a train back down to Hove in Sussex, where my parents lived.
And what was the process of the demobbing?
Oh, it was just a question of
ticking forms,
giving your discs out and getting your discs out and giving your pay, and I think they gave you something. I think they gave me, I think they must have given me something. You know, they used to have demob suits for men. I think they gave me something. I think it was, might have been about £50. And I got a coat for that, I remember, when I got back to Hove. So it was really took quite a short while.
Mm. It must have been a strange feeling.
It was awful.
To be so quick and suddenly
over. Oh, it was all so awful, awful. I couldn't bear it.
And what did you do in the first few weeks?
I was stayed at home with my parents. And then I think at the end of September, I think we'd managed to find somebody that was able to sort of look after my mother. She was getting better, although she was still not able to. She was pretty paralyzed. And by that time, I had decided that I wanted to become an almoner and go up and have my training with the Institute of Almoners in London. And because of my medical, not training, but my medical involvement for about, I suppose, 4 years, really, I was very, very lucky. I had several people who were quite high up in the medical profession that did know me, and they gave me very good references. And so I was given a special entry into a special course for members of the services who had done particular jobs in their service lives that would be would be comparable to a medical and welfare training in the future. And that, of course, would be an almoner. Well, I was accepted. And that started in January 1947. But before that, for 3 months, I managed to get a job as a guide at the Britain Can Make It exhibition in, I think it was Olympia. It was really great fun because all the women who were accepted had to wear very smart black clothes of their own, you know, which they wished. Mm-hmm. Had to be very, very well groomed, pearls and all the rest of it. And I was eventually able to fit the bill, and I was put in a large, huge hall where I took people around, etc. And I was standing, actually, with my back to a flight of stairs behind me, I think talking to one of the public, and they just left me when suddenly I had a huge, huge thump on my bottom. And somebody said, "Hello, Sergeant Major, how are you then these days?" And it was a chap from the nearby unit when I was a company sergeant major in, I think it must have been in Surrey, before I went up to Octo. But it was absolutely hilarious. And I stayed there until just before Christmas. And then I went straight off after Christmas to the Institute in, I think it was Tavistock Square I went. And then I got my full degree at the end. And then I went straight away. I got a locum for about 6 weeks. And then I got a job as radiotherapy almoner at the West Middlesex Hospital in Isleworth. But my job was to do the cancer patients in that hospital who needed treatment in the Middlesex Hospital. And I did I worked between the two hospitals in that capacity. And I stayed there for a year, which I loved it. I loved it there. But the pay was very, very scarce in those days. And I was finding it hard in London. And I happened to hear that there was a post for a senior almoner in the VD department in King's College Hospital. And having had that experience in the services, I decided to phone up and see if I might be shortlisted. I spoke to the head almoner, and she said that I was very lucky, as they had 20 applications for the shortlisting the following day, and would I like to attend? So I did so, and was accepted. And it was a confidential post, so my word was pretty It was a very confidential post and involved an awful lot of diplomacy with the patients who were attending the clinic. And about 14 months later, my elder sister had a nervous breakdown and was back in England from India. for a few months. And so I discharged myself there at King's and stayed with her for a month. And then my mother died about 2 months later. And so I never returned at that time back to hospital life for 11 years because I took 3 years with a great friend to Europe, thought we would work our way around for 3 months, but stayed 3 years, during which time we had very good jobs in Switzerland for 2 years and then a year in Norway. And then when we came back, we opened a fish restaurant in Hope Cove for about 6 years. And after 2 years, were on the Good Food Guide for Britain. And then my friend, my greatest friend for 47 years, she married a doctor, and I met my husband. And so after a year, we'd left and gone our different ways. But we were always fairly close, so we could visit each other very frequently. And then, when I met my husband, I went back to hospital work again and did that until I retired in 1978.
So you've always had that hospital connection?
Yes.
And it is interesting that when you were at King's College dealing with the VD clinic, that you were still dealing with some of the fallout from the war years.
Oh yes, very much so. Because so many of the, it was so sad really, so many of the contacts were lovely chaps that had gone to places like Africa or the Middle East or whatever, long away from home, sometimes for years at a time, and quite naturally they got friendly with very often very undesirable contacts, and of course absolutely desperate when they realized that they had contracted BD. And of course I didn't have to contact the men direct, but I always had to contact any women contacts. And it was always very hard when I had to contact the wife of a young professional man, perhaps, with his knowledge, of course, that his wife was also had been infected. So it was a difficult job very often. And then of course you had people that were very difficult to contact. Some of them needed to be contacted, and very difficult sometimes going to a home where perhaps the wife was the person who was the instigator, and explaining your reasons why you were there without telling them the reason why.
So an awful lot of sensitivity and tact,
yes,
and diplomacy.
Yes. Whilst I was there, I did 2 surgical wards as well, just to keep my hand in general work, you know, medical work.
Yeah. So, another difficult job.
So, yes.
I should, for the sake of completeness from the questions on this sheet, just ask you a couple more things.
Right.
which that's a complete hiatus with what we've just been talking about, but yes. Just to finish off, I know there are certain questions that they like to be asked about any contact you had with Allied forces. Did you ever come across the units or?
Oh, I came across a lot of Americans. A lot of Americans in 1951 to 53, mm-hmm. When I was in Switzerland, because we used to travel a lot, because we were both working at a big English school in Sheffield, in Les Avants, outside Montreux, and we had holidays, and so then we used to hitchhike all over Europe, and we got to know a lot of Americans in Germany, a lot of Americans in Austria. There were Americans everywhere, so I knew a lot about the Allied forces there, and we also met, of course, the Norwegians. No, we didn't have many Norwegians over, did we? No, we didn't. They were mostly Americans. Some English, obviously, but mostly Americans that we met in Europe, because you see, there were a lot of Americans over there. You know, when they came in 1942, didn't they, the Americans? Mm.
And it sort of leads into the last question I've got, which is a question about leadership. Because having been an officer yourself, and obviously having met other officers from the British Army and from the Allied forces as well, what would you regard as good leadership? That's a tough question to throw at you out of the blue, I'm sorry.
I think good leadership, if you have people that are reliant upon you, and you are reliant on getting the best from them, is to emphasize and work on their good points more than their weak. And that should give them some feeling of self-esteem and endeavour.
I'm sorry?
And the endeavour to do their best of the work they are undertaking. Always to be fair, and never to compare one of your subordinates with another. I think those are very important, those things, and I think also you've got to be firm, but you've got to be very understanding. And you've got to let that you think a lot of the people that are working with you, that they're worth being involved. And realizing the responsibilities they have and some of the difficulties that sometimes ensue.
Mm. It's been very interesting, absolutely fascinating, in fact. So thank you very much for
Not
speaking
a bit.
To us. Thank you.